So our passage this morning is the one that we read in two sections there, Acts chapter 6, verse 11 to chapter 7, verse 53. In October 2011, Sir Jimmy Savile, as he was then, died. And the newspapers were full of glowing obituaries all about this eccentric philanthropist who had brought such fun and energy to our television screens. Pretty much exactly a year later, October 2012, the newspapers were again full of Jimmy Savile, but now it was lurid tales about this vicious sexual predator. It was a remarkable contrast. I remember during those days when the stories were just breaking, his nephew being interviewed on the BBC and visibly reeling at these revelations, unable to comprehend, and these were his words, how his uncle could have had such a dark side to him. Our passage this morning reintroduces us to the council, as Luke describes it. That is the Jerusalem Sanhedrin. We've encountered the council before in chapter 4 and in chapter 5. This time, however, it's not Peter and John who are appearing before the council as it was in chapter 4. This time it's not the 12 apostles that are appearing before the council as it was in chapter 5. This time it's Stephen, this guy we met last week, one of the seven who were there appointed by the Jerusalem church to address this cultural tension that had emerged within the congregation. Now, if you had buttonholed a member of that council, that Sanhedrin, and you had said to him, look, I've got half an hour to spare, will you come down the road to the nearest Starbucks with me, and will you just talk me through Israel's history for a while? Will you just walk me through the history of Israel? If you had done that and he had been willing to comply, then you would have heard from him all about the privilege and the glory of Israel. You would have heard from that council member all about Israel's most impressive conquests and Israel's most inspiring heroes. You would have heard from him about Israel's most sacred institutions and most sacred possessions. You would have been treated to something a little bit like the October 2011 obituaries of Jimmy Savile, something glowing and effusive. In chapter 7, verse 1 here, Stephen is given the opportunity to address the council. Specific charges have been brought against him. Chapter 6, verse 11, we've heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses and God. Verse 13, he never ceases to speak words against this holy place and the law. And you'd have thought then that Stephen might just decide to respond directly to these charges that have been brought against him. But he doesn't do that. He does touch on them indirectly throughout the course of his speech, but he doesn't respond directly to the charges. Instead, he does something else. He gives his own version of Israel's history. And the version of Israel's history which he gives is different, radically different to that which any other person in that room, any member of the Sanhedrin, would have given. Stephen's version of Israel's history is more like the October 2012 take on Jimmy Savile. To borrow that phrase from his nephew, Stephen emphasizes the dark side of Israel's history. And that then is the theme of our sermon this morning, because that's the theme really of Stephen's speech, the dark side of Israel's history. And that being so then, let's just notice a few things. First of all, it's happy backdrop. It's happy backdrop. So just cast your eye for a moment over verses 2 to 8 of chapter 7. And you'll notice that there, actually, there's no dark side. There in that opening section, it's actually very bright and encouraging what Stephen talks about. The opening chapter, then, of his history of Israel, it features the founding father of Israel. Now, I know it's open to debate who the founding father of Israel was, and perhaps Jacob, in some ways, is the founding father. He gives his name, Israel, to the nation, and he's the one who begets the 12 patriarchs and so on. But I'm talking about Abraham. He's a more absolute beginning, isn't he, to Israel's story. And Stephen focuses then on him in the opening section of his speech and God's remarkable singling out of and dealings with Abraham. And Stephen emphasizes then that those dealings that God had with Abraham, they focused on one thing in particular. God made a promise to Abraham, a promise concerning the possession of a land which at the point the promise was made, Abraham, verse 5, didn't even possess a foot's length of. And a land, we're told in verse 7, and that really is a crucial verse, I think, a land where God would be worshipped. God promises a land to Abraham and a land where he would be worshipped. You will come out and worship me, or they will come out and worship me in this place. The implication being then that this land God was promising to Abraham would be God's own dwelling place. And so there Israel would meet with and would worship God. So that then is how Stephen's speech begins. And that's uncontroversial. There would be nobody in that room that had a problem with verses 2 to 8. Perhaps some of them would actually have been sitting there, beginning to think to themselves, why are we here? Why has this man been brought before us today? He's a perfectly orthodox guy. But if they were wondering that, they were soon about to find out, because with this bright and encouraging material, then Stephen is not setting the tone for the whole of his speech. Far from it. He is merely supplying the happy backdrop to the dark side of Israel's story to which he's about to come. And so, having noticed then the happy backdrop to the dark side of Israel's story, let's consider, secondly, its gory details. Its gory details. What is the dark side then of Israel's story? Well, it's just this. That possessing this promise of a land where God would dwell and where they would be able to worship God, possessing that precious, wonderful promise, the Israelites then went and rejected the one whom God had appointed to bring that promise to fulfillment. That's the dark side of Israel's story. Who am I talking about? Who was the one God had appointed to bring the promise to fulfillment? Well, it was, of course, Moses, and he is introduced by Stephen in verse 20. And the Moses part of the story is extensive. It runs from verse 20 there through to verse 44. And it really divides into three sections. The middle of the three sections is verses 30 to 38. And there Stephen describes God commissioning Moses, that famous scene at the burning bush. And he makes it clear that God there commissioned Moses with a dual role. Verse 35, ruler and redeemer. God gave him those two offices, those two roles of ruler and redeemer. And you'll notice then that the next verse, verse 36, it describes what precisely Moses' redeemer role was. this man led them out, i.e. he redeemed the Israelites from Egypt where they had become slaves. And that, of course, was a necessary component of the promise to Abraham being fulfilled. The Israelites weren't going to inherit this land where God dwelt as long as they were slaves in the land of Egypt. And so if the promise to Abraham was going to be fulfilled, Israel had to be redeemed first from Egypt, from bondage. And so Moses then was a redeemer. He led them out. And then if you jump to verse 38, it tells us what precisely Moses' ruler role was. It says there that he, the last part of the verse, he received living oracles to give to us, i.e. the law of God, which then as Israel's ruler, Moses was to impose and enforce amongst the people. And that too was a necessary component of the promise to Abraham being fulfilled. Because the Israelites weren't going to worship God properly in the land that they inherited if they didn't know how God was to be worshipped. And so they had to be given these precise regulations as to how God was to be worshipped. And that was much of the content of the living oracles which Moses received and then enforced amongst the Israelites. But you see, the key word in that middle section is in verse 35, and it's the word rejected. This Moses whom they rejected. And this is where the other two sections come in. Remember I said that verses 30 to 38 is the middle section of three in this Moses part of the story. So the first section is verses 20 to 29. And verses 20 to 29, we have the first 40 years of Moses' life being covered. And this, of course, is prior then to the burning bush and Moses' official commissioning by God. But it seems, doesn't it, from verse 22, another quite important verse, it seems that even though Moses hadn't yet been commissioned by God formally at the burning bush, it was already evident that he was being raised by God to be this special person. Because he was mighty in his words and deeds, Stephen says. Before the burning bush, he was already mighty in his words and deeds. And that's why then, when Moses makes this initial foray into the Israelite community, having been raised in the palace, when he goes and visits his brothers, verse 23, he assumes that they'll all recognize him as the Savior, the Redeemer, the one who's going to lead them out of Egypt. That's what it says, verse 25. He supposed his brothers would understand that God was giving them salvation by his hand. Because he was mighty in word and deed. Surely they would recognize this. But they didn't. Stephen says they did not understand. They didn't run to him as their redeemer. They didn't pin their hopes on him to redeem them. His mightiness in word and deed didn't impress them. They rejected him as redeemer. That's the first of the three sections. But then if we jump to the third section of the Moses part of the story, that's verses 39 to 44. Here we have Moses being rejected as ruler, rejected as redeemer, rejected as ruler. So we're told in verse 38 that he'd received these living oracles. Here he is then with all these words from God that he's received on Mount Sinai, all these regulations, how Israel are to worship God. These regulations about sacrifices, about the tent of witness that's mentioned in verse 44. Moses received the exact pattern of how the tabernacle was to be constructed. He'd received all this stuff about how God was to be worshipped. And what's Israel's response? Rejection. Verse 39, they thrust him aside. They thrust him aside. And then, which Stephen says, in their hearts they turned to Egypt. Not in their feet, they didn't literally go back to Egypt, but in their hearts, what does that mean? It means they, instead of regulating their worship on these living oracles that Moses had brought down the mountain. They looked to Egypt for religious inspiration, for theological guidance. And of course, what did Egypt say? Egypt said, there are many gods. And so what do the Israelites start saying? Verse 40, make for us gods who will go before us. And then verses 41 to 43, we have a depressing catalogue, don't we, of all this idolatrous worship, the worshipping of a calf that they've made. Verse 41, the worshipping of the host of heaven, that's the sun, the moon, the stars, verse 42. The worshipping of Moloch, verse 43, that's a Canaanite sun god. The worshipping of Rephan, verse 43, that's an Egyptian deity. And so you see then that they rejected Moses as ruler. So I'm saying, and this is the dark side of Israel's story. They had this wonderful promise given to Abraham, the promise of a land where they would meet with God and worship him. And then God raises up the man who's going to bring that promise to fulfillment. And God gives that man the two roles necessary for it. He's a redeemer and he's a ruler. But then at that point, the Israelites suddenly turn around and say, actually, God, no thanks. No thanks, we don't want this after all. They thrust Moses aside. They reject the chosen man. That's the dark side of Israel's story. So having surveyed then the gory details of the dark side of Israel's story, let's turn thirdly to notice its contemporary relevance. Its contemporary relevance. Now when I say contemporary, I mean contemporary on this day that Stephen is appearing before the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem. Because you might say, well, what's Stephen doing here? I mean, why is he raking up all this ancient stuff? Okay, he might be right that there was this profound, this pronounced dark side to Israel's story that all, though the other people in that room were conveniently overlooking. He might be right, but what's the point? Why is he harping on about it here? What's he doing? Where's he going with this speech? Well, at this point, I want us to just probe this speech a little more deeply and notice something strange, if you like, a paradox and an apparent contradiction that's at its very heart. Why was God going to give his people this land? What have we said about that? Well, it was so that he would dwell there. The land would be his dwelling place and they would worship him there. That's what verse 7 seems to be teaching. But then in the rest of the passage, we have several references, don't we, to God's presence. And the striking thing is that all of them involve locations which are outside the land which God was giving to his people. So verse 2, right at the start, the God of glory appeared to our father Abraham, where? When he was in Mesopotamia. Verse 9, the patriarchs, jealous of Joseph, sold him into Egypt, but God was with him, i.e. God was with him in Egypt. Verse 33, clearly, Moses there is in the presence of God. He has to take his sandals off because the place where you are standing is holy ground. But what is this place? Well, it's the wilderness of Mount Sinai, verse 30. And of course, this strand then of Stephen's speech reaches its climactic expression in verses 48 to 50, where Stephen says, the Most High does not dwell in houses made by hands. And then he quotes from Isaiah, heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. What kind of house will you build for me, says the Lord? Or what is the place of my rest? So how are we to make sense of this then? Here, God promising to his people this land that would be his dwelling place where they would worship him. And yet there's this pervasive theme throughout the speech that actually God is present in all these other locations. Well, where, according to those words of Isaiah, does God dwell? Well, according to those words of Isaiah, quoted by Stephen there, God dwells throughout heaven and earth. Heaven is my throne, and the earth is my footstool. If then God has promised to bring his people into the land where he dwells, what ultimately must that land be like? A little strip of soil in the Middle East somewhere called Canaan? No. If God has promised to bring his people into the land where he dwells, that land must ultimately be nothing less than heaven and earth. You see, I'm saying that the land God promised to Abraham wasn't really Canaan. That's why the actual entry into Canaan here in chapter 7 is so understated. If I were to ask you just now, where are we told of that? You'd probably struggle to find it for a while. It's in verse 45. Our fathers brought the tabernacle in with Joshua when they dispossessed their nations. It's a bit understated, isn't it? We've had all this stuff about the land. It's all been building up, and then they go into the land and Stephen hardly mentions it. The land that God had promised to Abraham wasn't really the land of Canaan. What's the point of the land of Canaan then? Well, as we often say, it was a type. It was a miniature model. It was a visual aid. It was a pale foreshadowing of the real land that God was going to give to his people. And once we appreciate that, it follows logically, doesn't it then, that Moses wasn't really the one whom God had appointed to bring the promise to fulfillment. Moses too was part of the type. He was part of the miniature model. He was part of the visual aid, part of the pale foreshadowing. And that's made explicit in verse 37, isn't it, by Stephen. This is the Moses who said to the Israelites, God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brothers. Moses himself said, I'm just a temporary signpost pointing to somebody else. And who's the real thing then? Well, Jesus, of course. He's the one who supremely is mighty in his words and deeds. That's the exact same language that we have in verse 22. We have of Jesus spoken by those two disciples on the road to Emmaus, Luke 24, 19. He's the one who supremely is appointed by God to be a redeemer and ruler, to truly fulfill the promise to Abraham and bring his people into a real promised land, a new heavens and a new earth, as Peter will later describe it to Peter 3:13, where properly his people will be able to worship him, where properly God will dwell in their midst and they will commune with him. It ties in with what Peter has said back in chapter 3, verse 21. You remember how he taught there about a day coming when all things are going to be restored. The creation itself is going to be restored. The physical universe restored. And that then is going to be the true promised land. And Jesus, as the true Moses, is going to lead his people into that land, a restored universe, a restored creation. And there his people will properly be able to meet with and worship God. But let's come back to this question for a moment. Why is Stephen emphasizing the dark side of Israel's history in this speech? Why is he emphasizing Israel's rejection of Moses? Well, because, as he makes clear in his conclusion in verses 51 to 53, a conclusion which is very, very devastating and biting, and for which he will pay with his life very soon. Because, Stephen says, the dark side of Israel's story isn't simply buried in ancient history. It isn't simply something that belongs to the Exodus period and the wilderness period. No, the dark side of Israel's story is in our recent history as well, Stephen is saying. In fact, he's saying it has just come to its worst manifestation of all. And the culprits now are not our fathers, people who lived a long time ago. The culprits now are you, he says to his audience. You. Our fathers rejected Moses, who was the type, the model. You, he says, have rejected the real thing. You've rejected the true ruler and redeemer. You've rejected Jesus himself. You've betrayed him and murdered him, Stephen says. This is why he's emphasizing the dark side of Israel's story, because it's an ongoing dark side. Because it had just reached its zenith, its climax, in the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, the ruler and redeemer of Israel. So that's the contemporary relevance of the dark side of Israel's story. But then, fourthly and finally, we must consider its mysterious episode. Its mysterious episode. It's striking, isn't it, how hopelessly the speech ends. I mean, there's not a note of hope there. I mean, in the apostles' speeches, in Peter's speeches, he's been equally accusatory toward the Jews, you crucified Jesus. But he's always brought in an invitation. He's always brought in a note of hope. You can turn from your rebellion. You can be saved nonetheless. But Stephen doesn't. Now, there's probably a reason for that. And the reason is probably that Stephen wasn't given the chance to get to that bit of his speech. Because, of course, his audience reacted. And we know what happens next. But I think there's something else that's relevant in this connection. There's a part of the story which I almost haven't mentioned at all. And that part is the Joseph part of the story. And you'll find that in verses 9 to 19 of Acts 7. And what are we to make then of this section of Stephen's speech? At one level, of course, it's necessary for his history of Israel to make sense. Because why is Moses redeeming the Israelites from Egypt? Well, because they'd become slaves in Egypt. How did they become slaves in Egypt? Well, because Joseph went to Egypt and then the family joined him there, and so on. So it's necessary for the whole story to hang together and to make sense. But I think there's more going on than that. You see, this Joseph section, it seems to belong to the dark side of Israel's story, doesn't it? I mean, we have here another redeemer and ruler of Israel, don't we? He redeems Israel from great affliction, verse 11, associated with a famine. And then his rule over Israel is signaled in verse 14 by those quite strong terms about him sending and summoning Jacob and all his kindred. He's ruling over Israel. So he's a redeemer and a ruler. And he's another redeemer and ruler who's rejected by Israel, isn't he? Verse 9, the patriarchs were jealous of Joseph. They sold him. They thrust him aside, just as Moses and just as Jesus was thrust aside. So it seems to belong then to the dark side of Israel's story, but it contains a hopeful note, doesn't it? Because in the case of Joseph, rejection is not the last word. The story ends with Israel living with Joseph in Egypt and accepting Joseph's kindness. There's reconciliation. There's peace at the end of the Joseph story. Rejection is not the last word, which raises the question, how is the rejection ended in the Joseph part of the story? Well, it's ended in verse 13, another crucial verse, I think, in this whole chapter. On the second visit, Joseph made himself known to his brothers. Joseph ends their rejection by revealing himself to his brothers. And I think there's perhaps a hint there from Stephen that just as Joseph ended Israel's rejection by revealing himself to them, so the greater ruler and redeemer than Joseph, Jesus, can end contemporary Israel's worst rejection through revealing himself to them. Perhaps even there's a hint that through Peter and John and Stephen and the others preaching on the streets of Jerusalem, Jesus is making his second visit, in the language of verse 13, and is, in the lives of many of Jerusalem's citizens, revealing himself to them, ending the rejection, bringing them into a peaceful relationship with himself. And that's where finally all of this comes to be relevant to us. Perhaps all your life you've been rejecting Jesus Christ as Redeemer and as Ruler, as Saviour and as Lord, as Deliverer and as King. Perhaps you've been rejecting him as the one who alone can take you into the ultimate promised land, which he is going to bring about when he returns. My prayer for you this morning is that Jesus, even today, even through the preaching of his word, will reveal himself to you, will end that rejection forever, and will bring you into a close and peaceful relationship with himself. All of us in this room this morning were one time rejecters of Jesus, those who thrust him aside. We may have done it in very outwardly conspicuous ways. We may have talked about how much we hated Jesus, or we may have done it in much more subtle ways, but we were thrusting him aside, whichever way it was. But he came, and through the preaching of his word, he revealed himself to us. And I pray that what he has done for many of us, he will do for you. Amen.